Hi, welcome to the analysis.news. I'm Paul Jay. We're going to be talking to Larry Wilkerson in just a few seconds. But before we get going, don't forget, there's a donate button on the website. If you're on one of the social media platforms, it would help a lot if you subscribe and whatever else, like and share and so on. But most importantly, go to the analysis.news and get on our email list because some of the social media platforms are screwing around with us. Particularly YouTube. We have shorts, for example, on YouTube where the exact same short on YouTube sometimes does 500, maybe 1,000, and the exact same thing is doing close to 450 or 500,000 on Instagram, which suggests to me that the YouTube algorithm is more targeting us than perhaps some of the others. One way around it, go to the website, watch us from the website, and get on the email list. And when you know there's a new story at least once every week. So back in just a few seconds with Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson. So welcome back. As most of you know, Larry Wilkerson used to be Colin Powell's chief of staff and is a regular guest and a good friend of the analysis.news. So Larry, the midterms are getting close. Just really a matter of weeks. And there's a lot of interesting things happening that haven't quite happened before. All of a sudden, socialism seems to be the issue of the elections. Of course, the Republicans are trying to make it so. But it's not the first time. Red Scare has been used to achieve political and economic objectives. But the other thing that's, I think, fascinating is the Iran war in particular, and of course, the genocide in Gaza. There's been a shift in a large section of American public opinion. Certainly, support for Israel is way down. And in particular, some of the election races having AIPAC money has become a real detriment in some of the Democratic primaries and some of the progressive candidates who are very much against the genocide in Gaza. And also have been calling out candidates that get AIPAC money, have been winning in spite of enormous amounts of money being spent by AIPAC and other conservative and right-wing funding mechanisms. So what do you make of the shift that's taking place as we head up to the midterms? And then after that, let's talk about how real the threats to the midterms are. Go ahead.
The demographic shift, I think, depending on the age group you look at, is real in terms of eroding support for the U.S.-Israel relationship. What that'll mean before now in the midterms or slightly after, or for that matter, for this war in Southwest Asia is anybody's guess. I can make some pretty grim guesses at it. But I think what we're looking at, after all, they deployed $32 million and defeated one of the most effective against their interests and against them, Israel, congressman in the House, Tom Massie, cost them $32 million out of their AIPAC fund to do that. But they still have about $165 million in that PAC and Super PAC fund, and they have almost $1 billion in their Hasbro account, which is the public diplomacy account, so-called. It's mostly a PAC, political opportunist PAC. So there's a lot of money to be deployed, and they haven't deployed a lot of it yet, and I'm sure they will between now and the elections, especially if it looks like either House is going to be lost or either situation is going to develop into some sort of majority that might be a little more inimical, although it's hard to say because Hakeem Jeffries looks to me as good an Israelite as any of the Republicans. So you've got a potential Speaker of the House who will only be better than Johnson in the sense that he's not a Christian nationalist and yearning for Armageddon. I just don't know what the impact's going to be that's going to be favorable to the Republic. I just don't, because Israel's still primed and ready to go with all of the influence that it usually deploys. That said, I do think there's a more serious problem developing, problems, period, developing, and you hinted at that. I'm not sure we're going to have anything like a reasonably free and fair election. And I'm not absolutely sure we're going to have an election. And I say that because I see things all around me here running amok every single day. And I see the two most powerful people in the administration out at the budget, Project 25 gentleman, you may recall, and the Deputy Chief of Staff for Policy, who's the most powerful man in the Trump administration. And that's Steve Miller. And I mean that across a broad spectrum of activities, not what the Deputy Chief of Staff for Policy would normally have as a portfolio. He is probably the most powerful man in the administration, partly because when he speaks, everyone understands that he's speaking for Trump. Whether he is or not is sometimes in question, but that's what everybody thinks, and they cower at that prospect, the ones that are left anyway. Secretary of the Army was probably the last person with any guts and courage, and he's gone now. So I just don't know what's going to happen, but I think you have to contemplate the range of things that could happen as being a major, and this is minimal, a major deployment of the brown shirts, including formidable ICE and militia forces, depending on the state and the nature of the election in that state, to a real draconian deployment of force to make sure the election goes their way, all the way to some sort of invocation of something like the Insurrection Act and a declaration of martial law in a particular battleground state or whatever, and deployment of both active and militia forces. I think we can expect any of those things, possibly depending on the degree of defeat that it looks like the Republicans are going to meet. And I don't mean this is all Trump. I put this at my party too, the Republican Party. I don't put anything past John Thune, and I certainly don't put anything beyond that Christian nationalist son of a gun who's, if Vance were to walk out, would be the Jerry Ford of America. Think about that for a minute, especially the condition, mental and otherwise, that Trump is in right now. And were I J.D. Vance, I'd leave. I mean, he's a young man. He's got plenty of money behind him. He's got some skills. He's got a fairly decent reputation right now, not just with the Republicans, but with some Democrats. And he's going to be absolutely contaminated if he stays. And he won't, if he runs in 28, he'll lose. There's no question in my mind, because he's just being contaminated right now. Not only has it been brought up very, very powerfully within the military community in particular, but in the security community in general, that he's the one who broke the tie vote in the Senate first time since 1947 and the creation of the SecDef position. He's the one that broke the tie vote on Hegseth. And right now, Hegseth is poison for this administration. I don't look for him to last much longer, but he might, because Trump is nuts and Miller doesn't want him to go. So he might, but he is poison right now, and he's poison for the military.
For anyone watching this that thinks Larry might be exaggerating the threat, go back to the election where Biden won, but in the September before that election, when Steve Bannon was on Tucker Carlson's show in a September before the November election and called for a Stop the Steal campaign, that's before the results of the people that had even voted, and described a campaign that we're going to war, which led eventually to the storming of Congress in January 6th. But more than that, according to, as people may have heard me go on about this before, 10 former secretaries of defense on January 4th essentially say there's a coup in progress. Admiral Stavridis, whose name I never pronounced correctly, has an article in Time magazine essentially saying there's a coup. And there's an explicit language in an editorial in the Financial Times January 4th, 2 days before the attack on Capitol Hill. An editorial of the Financial Times say, as bizarre as it seems, a coup is in progress in the United States. And then later, when the Congressional Committee investigates this, something which got almost no coverage, it turns out there was an actual PowerPoint about how they would declare martial law in some of the swing states, and the Army would step in, seize ballot boxes, and under the auspices of the Army, call new elections. This was an actual PowerPoint that the Trump's chief of staff said, well, we never took it seriously, but they handed over to the Congressional Committee. And there was a war room down the street in a hotel, which included people like Steve Bannon and others planning to assuming that Pence didn't certify the election, which was they expected him not to do, they were planning a coup. So the threat is very real that if they think they might lose both houses, why not act two, except now they actually have the White House?
You know, I would make two comments on that, more than two, but two substantial ones, I think. One, some of them have studied history, and this happened. What you just described roughly happened during Reconstruction and before it in the Civil War. Ballot boxes actually got picked up by military officers with sabers on, defending themselves in the middle of a crowd in Louisiana in particular. And out they went with the ballot boxes because they knew they were being stuffed by the white people. So it's happened before under different circumstances, of course, and we would probably, you and I, call those positive circumstances. But nonetheless, it shows how the government can deploy itself on the dime and do these sorts of things during elections. The second comment I was made is what I made right after January the 6th. I said it did not fail because the system held. That coup attempt failed because the coup plotters were incompetent. And the most prominent and damaging aspect in terms of their objectives, aspect of that failure was they did not have any state-sponsored force element on their side. It was at best standing on the sideline and at worst getting ready to object to anything they might want to do.
Well, go further, because Milley actually issued a directive to the armed forces to stay the hell out of the elections, the head of the army. But that brings us to exactly what's going happen this now, time. Because is there anybody now that would actually stop this thing from happening in the leadership of the armed forces? Because
Army's the most important force here in its militia or its active component, other than the Praetorian Guard that he's shaped up in Homeland Security, which could be probably all you'd need. We're talking about 100,000 plus. Especially to scare people to death and maybe even just in a preliminary way change the vote because people will be intimidated and won't even vote. But I think what we're looking at that Hegseth has done with the Army, which is the force for this, it's even in the law, it's even in the Constitution. When there are domestic disturbances inside the United States, it's not the Navy that's authorized to do things, nor the Air Force, nor other services, it's the Army. The Army has the domestic mission of keeping the peace, if you will, within the federal structure, if it is ordered to do so by a competent authority, and that's a big question. But what probably would happen is Hegseth has divested the Army right now. People are not paying attention to this. Of Randy George, the Senate confirmed four-star general in charge of the Army, of the second most important position in the Army, the DESOPS, which stands for Deputy Chief of Staff for Operations, very important position. I think the law, the DOM law, actually reads that he's the one in charge of the domestic element doing whatever needs to be done from the Pentagon. He's not there. No Senate-confirmed officer is there. No Senate-confirmed four-star Army general is in Europe for the Army troops in Europe, and General Grinkiewicz, the shaped commander, the SACEIR commander, Air Force four-star, is really irritated over that, plus our having expended all of his very valuable munitions like Patriots and THAADs and so forth in this war in Southwest Asia. He was apoplectic with General Kane, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, as were other combatant commanders. Don't you understand we have war plans? Don't you understand you're using all the elements of our war plans? What if we were to have to execute things like that? But coming back to the domestic situation, I could see an invocation of the Insurrection Act. That would be my guess at something that would go big, you know, the big option.
Well, there was a guy on Steve Bannon's show a couple of weeks ago. I forget his name, but he's one of these right-wing hosts of something or another. And he tells the story that there's this woman, I believe it was in Pennsylvania, who hit a cop and killed a cop with her car. And according to him, it turned out not only was she an undocumented immigrant here, but she voted in the last election. Now, he doesn't have any evidence, at least he didn't present any evidence, but he says that in itself is an indication that there's a justification for using martial law or some other kind of executive order, emergency executive order, to take control of the elections. So they're tying this whole immigration issue to the elections, which is a justification for a massive ICE presence around the polling booths. But I got to say, I think they may be underestimating the way people are going to react to this. I can imagine thousands of people in the streets protecting polling booths, confronting ICE.
I agree. I
think there's another really important moment we're in. The kind of Cold War mentality is starting to fracture. It's not by any means gone. But when Trump says we had to attack Iran because they had a nuclear weapon and you don't want to get attacked by a nuclear weapon, nobody's believing it. I can't say nobody, but if you look at the polling on the Iran war, it's very unpopular.
Yeah,
people are not getting scared by the nukes are coming at you. You need us to protect you. All the normal stuff that used to work ain't working the same way anymore.
Yeah, if I hadn't seen the absolute supine nature of the legislature exhibited so vividly over the last few months, and to a large extent, the supine or at least the receptive nature of the American people, I would say we're headed for a civil war. But just because of those two elements, I discount that, not totally, but I discount it in a way that I wouldn't otherwise, because I don't see the American people picking up a, you know, whatever, a bar, a rock, a gun, or even though we're awash in guns and awash in the ammunition for those guns, I don't see it happening. But I do see the possibility out there that we could have a civil war.
Well, the positive thing I'm seeing is a lot of these candidates that are challenging in the primaries, the conservative right-wing Democrats, essential to a large extent, very pro-Israel Democrats, and in many cases winning, they have thousands of volunteers, thousands of people knocking on doors. And I can imagine thousands of people hitting the streets in opposition to an attempt to impose martial law. I think even some state governors are going to refuse to go along. This is going to get potentially so disruptive that I can see where maybe they're saying to Trump, you know, maybe it's time to go spend your billions and go home and install a supposedly reasonable J.D. Vance. But, you know, this ain't, you know, there's a point where this isn't good even for that cabal of Christian nationalists. It's particularly not good for the larger billionaire class and Wall Street. You know, there's a point where this ain't good for business.
That's something that I understand has been presented by several people with some concern about their own longevity in the administration, but nonetheless presented to Miller. And Miller has simply scoffed that off.
You know, I interviewed Miller in 2016, and he was a nobody. He was like a tailing along with the Trump campaign. He was wandering around looking for people to interview him. And everyone had left the press room. You know, you go, people may not know, when there's big primaries and stuff, they have a room and all the media, you know, the radio's all here and video media's here and candidates and spokesmen and pundits, they walk around trying to get interviewed. So I had a little booth everyone had mostly gone. I'm packing up and Miller looked so lonely. Anyway, out of pity, honestly, I had no idea what he'd become. I said, well, I'd love to interview you. So I sat down. And he spent half an hour, 45 minutes, trying to persuade me on his views on immigration. And one, I said, listen, if you're really serious about stopping immigrants coming to the border, why don't you put some money into Central America, like a Marshall Plan for Central America? And then people, you know, it's not like people want to go. And he would, my point of the story is, I was so impressed with what a mediocre mind he was. Like he's not even clever where, you know, Vance is not stupid. Rubio's not stupid. Miller is like a mediocre brain. And I'm just surprised at how much power he seems to have.
I'm surprised too. I don't know him at all, but I'm surprised that a deputy chief of staff for policy would be described to me by a person whose views I rely upon a lot and consider reliable as more powerful than Susie Wiles, more powerful than anybody else in the White House other than the president himself. And the main reason is because he knows how to channel the president's wishes. And when people talk to him, like Joe Kent, for example, when they talk to him, they know that when he says something is coming from the president, he may be lying, but he will make sure that Trump thinks it's coming from the president too. And he has the ability to do that. And so they're scared to death of him. I mean, okay. Cabinet officers, Rubio is scared of Miller.
That's so crazy to me. Obviously, I'm not a very good judge of character or something. Because if you had asked me back then where Miller's going to wind up as some man of influence, I would have said, nah, he's too stupid.
I've heard people who are now not in the administration anymore, who left of their own volition, call him the Reinhard Heydrich of the administration, if you know who Reinhard
is. No, explain.
He was Hitler's man who went out to kill and kill and kill and kill. And was finally assassinated by some Slovak, Czechoslovakian is what the record said, but they were Slovaks.
You know, and actually, sorry, something connected for me. Of course, Trump wants a mediocre brain to have such power because he's someone that will never say no to Trump.
Yeah, and he's got a fixation, and the fixation is on the things that he has ascertained Trump has a fixation on, like immigration and like voting and like not being reelected. He's playing those things like a Stradivarius.
Okay, based on what you know now of who's left at the top leadership level in the Joint Chiefs, you know, particularly the Army, as you said, are they yes men? Have they gotten rid of anyone that might say no?
It's hard to say because you never know when someone's going to stand up and suddenly feel like he needs to stand for his country rather than himself or herself. But what I see is a lot, and it's a combination of things. It's people just praying that they get through their 3 or 4 star billet so they can get that $600,000 billet with Lockheed Martin or whatever and get that sinecure for the rest of their lives. It's people who simply don't understand what they're dealing with when they talk about things like coups. They simply follow the leader. And that's what's become the sort of sine qua non of Army leadership, is following the leader with some exceptions. Milley was probably the, and even Milley, I would have accused of this, until he made that walk across the park to the church. And then Milley began to see with the eyes of not just an Army general, but a historian, and understand what it was he was undertaking and what the president was, you know, using him to do. And his statement after that to the forces, as it were, was quite eloquent. And it showed that he understood that aspect of history that he was totally violative of, meaning the Constitution and everything it stood for, and who was doing it to him. That hasn't happened. That epiphany has not arrived with other leaders.
Remind people about that scene that you just described with Milley and the Bible and all this.
Right. They're all walking across, and Trump is, I think it was Lafayette Park, and they're going to the church there. And it's all.
It was right across from the White House.
Yeah. And it's all staged. In order to make it look as if the chief of staff, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, because he was chief of staff before that, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff is his tool. And to make it look as if that means the military is his tool. And they will follow him to any place, including the church, and swear on the Bible that they're his tool. And that was the image. And it struck Milley, I think, in mid-route, as it were, that this is not the way I should be displaying myself in uniform before the commander in chief. He is using me. I'm his tool. That's not what my job is. And it struck him a little late, but it struck him, and he made an apologia, if you will, immediately to all the general and other leaders in the Army, and then sent a message out to the troops. I hope you weren't watching, but if you were watching, this is my apology to you for what I did. I think that's when he turned off the spigot with Trump, too. I think Trump knew from that moment on he had to watch him carefully, but he didn't seem to have the courage, as he says he has all the time, to fire him, to to get rid of him. It would have been too much of a political act and too public. They don't seem, he has egg set to do that now. And it doesn't seem to bother him at all if he strips the army of its leadership, such as it is. Paul, I wouldn't give you 10 cents for most of the flag officer, admirals, and generals' leadership of the military period. Wouldn't give you 10 cents for him. I was just telling you about Bradley Cooper. Bradley Cooper, the admiral, the surface warfare admiral, who went to Lincoln and stood on the deck like George Bush did, you know, on his carrier, and said, there's nothing wrong with this ship. And this guy was blind and dined by Israel, as was his predecessor at Central Command. They spent as much time with the Israeli military and being wined and dined and toured through Israel on the basic fundamental tour, you know, where they go and are shown how everything is so wonderful and so terribly dangerous for Israel, and you have to be on our side all the time. They got the full Mahdi from Israel. Both of them might be working for the IDF, as well as the United States Navy and the United States Marine Corps, as the previous thing. I wouldn't give you 10 cents for the leadership of our military.
Which brings us to what's happening in Iran, the Strait of Hormuz. I mean, right now you would think this should be pretty humiliating for Trump, and the military leadership can't like what's going on. But I'm actually surprised that the U.S. isn't being more aggressive at this moment. Is it because they can't?
They don't have the wherewithal to be more aggressive. In fact, their wherewithal to be more aggressive is being eroded every moment, being eroded even as I speak. And we've just misinterpreted so many things. And I lay this at General Kane, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs right now. I lay it at his feet as well as the other flag officers. Look at mine warfare, for example, Paul. What mine warfare is a, mine warfare is a component of warfare that is well beyond what you see. That is to say, the moment you threaten mine warfare, and it only takes one mine in the water, one mine contacting a ship and damaging it. That's all it takes. Insurers want insurer, shippers want ship, because they have to be assured that that's not going to happen again. And it's not happening. It's not happening. And Iran is actually putting both contact and submersible mines in the strait still. So, I mean, we don't have any really countermine measure capability anymore, because we divorced it all from ourselves to save money and gave it to countries like Norway and Finland and so forth in NATO. They have that capability. We always thought we'd go to war with them, and therefore we would have that capability too. So we're having to jury rig any kind of mine warfare we're doing in the strait right now. And being, you know how fast a mine warfare ship goes anyway? Maybe a knot or two, because it doesn't want to hit the mine itself and it wants to detect them. So just the image of there being mines in the Strait of Hormuz has closed it.
How significant is this deal with Saudi Arabia in terms of nuclear uranium processing, so on?
It's a cop-out. It truly is a cop-out. If you, on the one hand, object, even though your own intelligence community told you it wasn't true, to Iran's building a nuclear weapon, and you don't want them to have the latent capability to do so, and turn around and give that capability carte blanche to Saudi Arabia, how stupid is that? I mean, just how stupid is that? And especially since they've now formed this entente. It isn't an alliance. Anybody that calls it alliance is nuts. It's an entente. And the purpose of the entente is directly the opposite of what the American press picked up and European press and started touting. It's an alliance against Israel. It's clearly against Israel. It's got the only character in the Gulf region that still is stuck in Israel's back pocket and has been for 30 years, 40 years, is UAE, the little Sparta. And there is Israeli.
There are people that haven't followed it. Explain what this entente is, who it is.
Well, it puts together some disparate countries, if you will. It puts together Turkey, it puts together Pakistan, it puts together Saudi Arabia, all in an alliance, supposedly. It's not an alliance, as I said. Call it an entente. But the image given off by the American press is that it was all designed to be against Iran. It's not against Iran, it's against Israel. And one of the most,
and an alliance that has nuclear weapons because of Pakistan.
Yes. And I think MBS, many years ago, when he was defense minister, went to Islamabad made a gift of $20 billion to Pakistan. And I think at any time he wants 10 or 12 nuclear weapons, he can get them.
Oh, like Pakistan without Saudi Arabia loses most of their schools, a whack of their funding. Saudis have been funding the madrasas in Pakistan. They have a whole army, a fanatical army they can unleash there. But they're like this. The Saudi Arabia has all the nuclear weapon technology already.
That's true to an extent, but the Pakistanis are rapidly being recruited to, and very solidly so, China's camp.
Which is not necessarily contradictory in terms of I think the point you're making here is very important. Maybe I sidetracked it a bit. Is that this what the Iran war showed these countries is that this wasn't about any existential nuclear threat from Iran. It's that Israel wants to be a regional hegemon.
Yes.
And they're responding to it.
The Omani foreign minister summed it up twice in English. He said the threat in the region is not Iran, it's Israel. In English, he said that. And the Omanis are very circumspect about their diplomacy and their words.
Well, so let's go back domestically again, because people watching this, you know, they're always left with this question, well, what can I do? And I think there's actually a moment here where there's maybe more people can do than in the past, because the batshit craziness of the Trump White House is disturbing a lot, even amongst the elites. A lot of the Cold War consensus is cracking. And there's going to be a very practical question about not just getting out and voting, but getting organized to resist in different ways. I mean, what would you say to people who say, okay, I've heard you, now what should I do?
That's a very important question, I think, and it gains in importance as you contemplate the more drastic or severe aspects of what the administration might do. And I'm sad to say what the political party that I'm a member of might join in doing to save their jobs. And also, we have to remember to save whatever accountability or payback they might be contemplating were the majority to shift in one house, in just one house.
Yeah, imagine if it's both.
Yeah, let alone both. The payback is going to be extreme. And they don't want that. They simply don't want that. So I think the only thing that could stand up against the more draconian things that this administration might do is massive, massive people in the street. Everywhere that it looks like it's a borning, you need to have also a borning, massive protests. And not for a day. You might have to stay out there for a week. And you might have to do some major sacrificing of your happiness and your joy and your home life and everything else, and stay in the streets. They can't deal with 300 million Americans opposed to what they want to do, or even 100 million opposed to what they want to do, or even 25 million opposed to what they don't want to do in key places. They just can't. Not without murdering people with machine guns. Think about the Anacostia Flats and Douglas MacArthur. And God help us, if Eisenhower hadn't been there and some other people to restrain that man, he would have machine gunned those bonus marchers. Well, that's what we're talking about writ large across certain states where it's going to be dicey.
Yes, sir. People don't know. Look up Smedley Butler. You'll get what the bonus march was about. All right. Well, thanks very much, Larry. And let's keep talking a lot more often between now and the midterms. Once again, if you want to donate some money to theanalysis.news, that would certainly help. Get on the email list and join us at theanalysis.news. Come to the website. Frankly, the social media people are screwing around with us too much. Our website numbers are quite good. And the better our email list is, the less vulnerable we are to the algorithms. Thanks, Larry.
Surely. Take care.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.